change in family mealtime interaction.
Thank you very much, Charles, and thanks to Charles and Liz for organising this day. I'm going to talk about, rather pretentiously, about behaviour change. It's a bit of a kind of holy grail in psychology, social psychology especially, and sociology. So I just thought, why not tackle the big issues and see where we get with an interactional kind of approach to it. So it's very much work in progress, probably slightly chaotic, but let's see how we go. And it's part of a broader kind of conversational, analytic, discursive psychology project of kind of reconfiguring what sociological and psychological traditional notions of the person, of the world, as more occasioned, more interactive phenomena. So hopefully it will fit into that kind of project. So we're starting with a particular setting. Hello, Malcolm. family meals. And so what we can see, or at least what I'm hoping we can see, with behavior changes is it kind of sits in the middle of these other sorts of things within this kind of setting. So speech act notions like directives, which Alex Craven and Jonathan have looked at, threats, which Jonathan and I have looked at, requests, physical coercion even. So there's a set of activities going on. That speech act, you might think that they kind of belong in that sort of category. And all of this is embedded within a set of kind of age-related asymmetries in who knows what, who has the competence to do what, and who has the entitlement to tell other people to do what, and so on. And it's also distributed across a load of different settings, such as family breakfast tables, and integrated with a range of more or less explicit projects of what I guess you might want to start calling socialization. Projects such as generation of peace and quiet, getting healthy food eaten, maintaining authority and autonomy, herding small people into appropriate categories and roles. And all of this you can see going on in this very contained setting of a family meal. So really interesting place to start. And it's important to note at Loughborough that we work very much in a group kind of context, as Charles was saying. So we have various postgraduates working on these kinds of issues, like Carrie Childs looking at family conflict, Laura Jenkins looking at managing expressions of bodily discomfort, Alex's work on directives, Chloe Shaw looking at relationality. Basically, we have a bunch of people, and what that allows us to do is to start to try and map out the terrain in this kind of way and think about producing a clearer set of things that are going on in this environment. So the data that I'm working with today is a corpus of recordings of 16 family meals. And what we have in terms of ethical permission is permission to play them in research environments as they are uncut. And also to have them in papers anonymized with transcript. So in terms of the recording, it depends what you're gonna do with it. I mean, I wouldn't like it put on a website or anything, but shared in a research environment is fine as far as the family's concerned. So in this family, we have two girls. We've got two girls, Anna, aged 3 on the left, Catherine, aged 5 on the right, And there's obviously a father and mother, but father isn't in this particular clip. White British, both parents are school teachers. And in this family, typically, as in many British families, and I'm sure other nationalities of families, there's various practices that sound like pressuring, hectoring, cajoling, admonishing, warning, and so on. And so what this allowed us to do is to take these discrete projects. So Jonathan and I have looked at threats in family meals. So I'll just play you an example of that to get us going. Hopefully this will...
Emily, if you carry on whinging and whining, I've had enough of it. This is your warning now. If you carry on whinging and whining during breakfast time, I'll send you to the bottom step. We don't want this to
be
this is extract one on your handout. Jonathan's got some. So what we can see, I guess, is to point up some interesting features that we've looked at with respect to threats. And then I'll be talking more broadly about how these fit in with the developing project. So we've got some kind of protest from Catherine up to about line 11. She evidently feels some entitlement to sit where she wants to sit and not where she's told to sit. And she speaks with a mixture of upset, disappointment, protest. And again, this is another interesting project to think about the prosody of particular turns and the range of emotional states, presumably, was what psychologists would call them, that are embedded within the kind of prosodic features. And Mum hears this as whinging and whining, and produces what we could see as a candidate threat on line, I guess that starts on line 9, and it has some interesting features that I'm going to talk a bit more about as we go along, but the repeated summons on line 9 and 10, Catherine, 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 if you carry on. So it's got this if-then structure that formulates a problem action, whinging and whining, and then a negative upshot being sent to the bottom step, which is a bit like a kind of naughty chair or a kind of timeout sort of thing. That is a punishment for bad behaviour. And as Anna notes further down, and a further punishment would be to be sent to the bedroom. And they often prefer being sent to the bedroom. There's more things to do. So Anna's doing her sister a favour here. There's various other features like a kind of account explanation, had enough of it. Mum explicitly names the action, this is your warning now, so she calls it a warning. The negative upshot is left until last in this kind of if-then kind of structure, and as such it's the most proximate thing for the recipient to deal with. And then a further account is added, we don't want to listen, which with the person reference features obviously treats everyone, like, includes Anna as part of enrolling Anna, sort of dispersing Mum's own agency in producing this noxious upshot. So it's not just a product of her personal inclination. And she characterizes it as a warning. This is interesting. And so I looked at a bunch of things that where warning is produced in everyday conversation. So like in example two from the Holt corpus, we have Dina warning Mark that his daughter's wedding will make a hole in his pocket on line seven. So what I thought would be interesting was to think about, like, what is the difference between doing a warning and doing a threat? So if you do a warning, like here, it's not necessarily a bad thing to do, I guess. It's like, I'm warning you that you'll end up spending lots of money. So it's not a negative upshot that Dina has any control over. Is one of the crucial things about a warning. So to name what you're doing as a warning could be seen as like, I'm merely helping you out. I'm merely telling you what bad stuff is going to happen if you carry on doing what, you know, what you're doing. So again, it's like there's issues for the parent in doing this action of kind of reducing their own agency, I guess, in doing it. Agency, for want of a better word, really. And so she's kind of trying to soften her role, I guess, in this kind of affecting this noxious kind of upshot.
5 minutes.
Okay. So in terms of So basically, one focus for the collection, which is very much work in progress, is if we're thinking of behavior change, how do we produce behavior change that endures beyond this particular setting? And this is the problem, I guess, for parents. And this, I guess, is a classic socialization problem within sociology, say, or psychology. And in terms of it as a kind of cognitivist psychological problem, how do we produce a person who thinks about things in the right kind of way? What we see when we look at interaction is that you can see parents managing both of these features. So part of producing a person is, as in control of themselves, is producing them as someone with an internal life over which they have already some kind of control, and indeed ought to have more control. So, and this gives rise to a kind of dilemma of control in the sense that the more entitlement I give myself to tell you what to do, the less able I am to orient to you as someone who is in control of themselves. So there's this kind of dilemma that you can see played out interactionally in these extracts. So we've looked a bit at various features, assessments such as, what have we got? Extract 4, line 6, just sit nicely and wait for mummy. So we've got some sense here that the child knows what sitting nicely is. We've got extract 3, line 6, you're being a naughty girl. So there's, again, there's kind of a sense of the crucial role of assessments in this kind of stuff. And they're very useful things for sanctioning problem behavior, accounting for actions, encouraging good behavior, and so on. We've also looked at the summons issue, and typically what we get is these turn initial summons. So like extract, where are we? Extract 5, line 8, Anna, and it's done kind of with warning intonation, so it's kind of sounding like Anna. So it kind of, you know, you can hear it as there's something bad coming up. And what that allows the recipient to do is, because we can see line 9, extract 5, you've got a 1.1 second delay where the recipient has the opportunity to modify their behavior in some way. So we're really interested in these kind of summons, answer, not answer sequences. And obviously with co-present data, one way of responding to a summons is simply to direct your gaze. So the whole physical orientation of the different participants becomes really interesting as well. Okay, so that's just to give you a quick, in 15 minutes, to give you a quick sense of where we're going with all of this. And I guess one of the crucial things has been to try and think how of this kind of dilemma of control, and how do you get a person in this position thinking about, as producing them as thinking about things in the right way. And that's been a really interesting way of organizing the collection and developing it. And I'll stop there, because I can explain more with questions probably.
Thank you, Lecter. All right, good time there for queries, comments, questions. Robert?
So if I can kick something off, I mean, one of the things that's kind of conspicuous throughout this is the way in which doing the right thing is not expressed as mother's preference.
Yeah.
And you have this sort of recurrent set of formations which characterize this as, you know, here is a computation of the personal moral order, of which I know more than a voice.
Yes.
So you get that, you know, the warning, you see it in 3, you know, you're not doing the right thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's not, I'm declaring what the right thing is. The right thing is...
it just exists, yeah.
And then we need to do that, just sit nicely and wait for mummy.
Yeah.
It's the we, and just sit nicely and wait for mummy. It's not wait for me.
Yeah.
It's sort of mummy is put into the third person as somebody who is subscribing to that. So, you know, you kind of, you know, if you want to put it in sticks, still, you know, this kind of impersonality that runs through it.
It's very interesting, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's one of the things we've looked at, especially with reference to Derek's work on scripting and how you can invoke a generalized version of events of, like, what ought to be done. Yeah, that's another of the kind of domains that we've identified as interesting. The way that these things are embedded within things like directives and threats and so on. Yeah.
But I think in terms of the challenges you're putting up there, that's actually quite important, because it implies an order.
Yeah.
That is more than second specific, more than first specific.
Absolutely, yeah. Sorry, yeah, I mean, that's definitely one thing we're looking at, but it's within a 15-minute time frame. It's hard to try and cover everything.
Yes, Ollie.
Hi. Obviously, you spoke about two categories of things, at least warnings and threats. And I know when you mentioned threat in the first instance, I felt somewhat uncomfortable about that. And I was just thinking, what the actual sense-making process of differentiating those kinds of things, a warning and a threat. And in actual fact, I've kind of gotten nowhere with it, because I was sitting here thinking, well, maybe the difference between a warning and a threat is a kind of if-then construction. If this happens, then so and so outcome. But then I thought, you can have a threat like, let's say you have to excuse me, I'm going to kick your ass.
Mm.
you know, and we can immediately identify that as a you know with threatening intent. So I wondered if you had a kind of tighter structural concept of, you know, what we're talking about when we're talking about a threat, and if indeed that is different from a warning.
Well, I think one of the things that we're dealing with here is a specific setting in which there are element, kind of pedagogic elements, I guess, going on. So you wouldn't just get a parent saying, out of the blue, I'm going to send you to the bottom step. You know, it would always be in the context of some problem behavior. So I guess in that sense, you always get this more elaborate sort of version of what the threat is.
Yeah.
Whereas perhaps in interactional terms, what you just said would be in the context of an ongoing dispute of which, you know, problem behavior was quite evident on both sides, perhaps. I don't know.
Mm.
But I mean, I haven't really looked at other settings, I guess is what I'm saying. And what we found in these settings is that there's a crucial attention paid to the agency of the person doing the threatening action. And there are various ways that you can manage this. And a lot of how you manage it relates to dealing with, you know, trying to give the other person some kind of sense of control over their own lives, I guess, as much as possible.
Okay, I think we better stop there. So thank you once again, Alexa.
Thank you.